It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farah. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, it's one thing to take art classes, but what if the arts were a part of teaching itself? A Wisconsin teaching artist and researcher talks with us about what that could look like in the classroom. First, Social Security benefits are projected to increase nearly 10% next year as cost of living adjustments reflect higher inflation. It's a bit of good news for retirees who depend on those benefits, but it comes as the Social Security system faces a looming shortfall in the future, with its surplus projected to be depleted by 2035, which could lead to cuts in benefits if funding for the system goes unchanged. Current economic conditions can make it challenging to navigate retirement finances, whether you're already out of the workforce or you're planning for it at some point in the future. Our next guest is with us to help us better understand the issues facing Social Security and how we can best prepare for them. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you receiving Social Security benefits right now? How has inflation affected you? Are you making plans trying to figure out when to start taking the benefits, you or maybe an older loved one? Call it at 800-642-1234 with your experiences, your questions. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Carrie Hannon is a personal finance and retirement expert and a senior columnist for Yahoo Finance. She's the author of a bunch of books on working, money, and aging. Her latest is called In Control at 50 Plus, How to Succeed in the New World of Work. Carrie, welcome back to Central Time.
Terrific. Great to be here.
Let's start off with inflation and how it affects Social Security-related decisions. What are you seeing out there?
Well, yeah. So what's happened this year has been pretty phenomenal, right? The inflation has just been skyrocketing. Now it's settled down a bit, but we had a pretty rough go of it. And I think what we're going to see for especially people who were currently on Social Security, living on a lot of that fixed income, it was a bit of a shock as the prices took off, right? But now we're talking about the experts I've talked to going forward, it looks like we may see the largest increase since 1981 in that Social Security benefit for next year. Now, they don't announce this until October, and it kicks in January. But this could be really a nice savings for the people who have really been, seen a lot of their benefit being eroded away.
Yeah, exactly. I mentioned that was a projection. I don't want anybody to write that into their budgets just yet. But can you talk about how that cost of living adjustment works? This is something that the system evaluates every year, right?
Right, they do. It's once a year adjustment, and they do it in October. But they base it on what the inflation, and it's sort of a funny number. It's close to the inflation number we hear about a lot. But the cost of living adjustment for Social Security, it could increase 9.6% maybe. But what it is they look at July, they look at August, and they look at September, and they say what's the environment out there for inflation, and where should we land? Now again, the first checks, once they announce that in mid-October, it doesn't take effect until the checks that go out in January. So there's a bit of a lag there.
Now, if someone is receiving Social Security, they get this bump in benefits next year, cost of living. Like, does that look like an increase in their income? Does that affect them in other areas, whether it's federal benefits or anything else?
Oh, that is a super good question. That the issue is, it can. It can really, but it can impact. There's a study I saw by the Senior Citizens League that found that 39% of their participants who received low income benefits that they reported for their low income assistance, it would be reduced. And for this year, we had a 5.9% cost of living adjustment. Those people, 39%, had their benefit reduced because of the 5.9% from this year. So yes, indeed, you could lose some access to your assistance programs depending on where you are on that income stream.
We're talking to personal finance retirement expert Carrie Hannon, looking at Social Security, how to manage your decisions related to Social Security, the impact of inflation, and the future of the program. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your experiences or your questions. That's 800-642-1234. Carrie, I want to get to that 2034, 2035 a deadline. We hear some pretty dire predictions. I hear some other people say, maybe a minor tweak. What is going to happen in roughly, 12, 13 years?
Exactly. And that's going to be here before you know it. The truth is, you know, we do need the PR policymakers to be taking a look at this. And here's what's happened. This is really quite understandable, is because you've got to figure we don't have as many young people coming into the system as the boomers have moved through the system and are now tapping their Social Security benefits. So what they're saying is that it's not going away. You're not going to lose Social Security entirely, but it could be a drop down to 70% of that benefit for, say, millennials and those coming behind after 2034, 2035, whatever, you know, wherever we see that fall with this big increase. If that happens for next year, it could come sooner, right? So it's very important that they take a look at this and how we're going to fund it moving forward, because I mean, it really is that, you know, the income the people are paying in, those are the ones who pay for the people who are currently taking benefits.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Jeff is with us by Pulaski. Jeff, hi.
Hello, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my phone call. What is the cap where people do not pay Social Security taxes anymore? Is it $250,000, $400,000?
Jeff, thanks for the call. That cap he's referring to, Carrie, if I make up to a certain amount of money, I pay Social Security, I pay into the system. Money I make beyond that, I don't. Where is that line now?
So this is my understanding, okay? If you file federal tax return as an individual and your combined income is between $25,000 and $34,000, you may have to pay a tax on up to 50% of your benefits. If it's more than $34,000, up to 85% of your benefits may be taxable. If you file a joint return and you and your spouse have a combined income that is between $32,000 and $44,000, you may have to pay income tax on up to 50% of your benefit, and more than 44%, it's up to 85% of your benefits may be taxable. And, you know, that's the situation we're in today. Yeah.
Oh, Jeff, thanks for that call. I want to look at the other end of the system for people who are currently paying into the system. How much, like there's that, I think a cap where if you make over $130,000 or something like that, you only pay into the system up to that amount. Do I have that about right?
I think you do. I don't have that number right in front of me, but that sounds about right.
Jeff, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Carrie, I think a pretty common question is people, you know, start to get into that neighborhood of retirement ages. Hey, at what age should I start drawing Social Security benefits? What are some of the factors they should weigh?
Well, I'm so glad you asked that question, because I'm a big fan of telling people that if you can, if you possibly can, bump back tapping into that benefit until you're 70, right? You can get full retirement at your full retirement age, which has been bumped up to between 66 and 67, I think it is, as we've edged up. You can have the full thing, and you can start early, certainly at 62. But to get the full amount of your, you know, benefit, if you can wait till 70, they built in this incentive in the system to do that, and you get 8% annual increase from your full retirement age up until age 70. That's kind of sweet, and it's really worth it if you can, you know, if you can delay those retirement credits. You'll get that 8% annual retirement credit if you can delay, you know, taking that, just pause it and don't take that benefit until you reach age 70. Not everyone can do that. That's absolutely true. But the math does work out very nicely for many people if you can stay on the job, or at least refrain from tapping into it until you hit 70.
Thanks again for that call at 800-642-1234. And Carrie, you've written about this, at least leading up to the pandemic, people have been working later, answering those incentives in part. What do you think is driving people to stay in the workforce, you know, later into their 60s?
Yeah, they truly are. And I think that most people, the retirement age, I just saw a Gallup poll that said it's the average is 66, which certainly means that some are higher and some are lower, you know, but the point is people are staying on the job longer. And I think, yes, without question, it's been the inflation we've seen this year. People have been a little nervous about that. They've been nervous about the stock market, with so many of us who have 401k plans now, and a lot of our retirement assets are invested in the stock market. And when you see that jitteriness, it makes you go like, whoa, you know, and there were some big drops. And so people thought, you know what, maybe if I can stay on a little bit longer, this is a good thing. And then also the other thing that's keeping people on the job really is this idea that you don't tap into Medicare till age 65, and very few companies now offer retiree health insurance. And so if you can stay on the job where you get health care benefits up until you reach 65, that's a really good strategy, because when you're on your own, it's not so it can be quite expensive for individual coverage. And that is, so it's the medical, it's the inflation, and it's the stock market jittery that has people saying, let me see if I can work a little bit longer.
We're talking to finance columnist and retirement expert Carrie Hannon about the challenges facing the Social Security system and how we can navigate them, make our retirement decisions along the way. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you delayed your retirement longer than you had planned, or longer than you see, you know, as the norm? Maybe the age your parents retired. What led you to do that? If you're already retired, have you gone back into the workforce? Are you currently making a decision about Social Security, when and how to take it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation with Carrie Hannon, retirement expert and the author of several books on working and aging. Her latest book is called In Control at 50 Plus, How to Succeed in the New World of Work. She's with us today to talk about Social Security, how we can prepare ourselves for retirement. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about Social Security and retirement planning? If you're retired, are you already receiving benefits or putting it off? Let us know. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Rich is with us in Two Rivers. Rich, hi.
Yeah, hi. Yeah, thanks for taking my call. Hey, Carrie. I got a question. I took Social Security at 62, and I still work. And I made, I don't know, $6,000 more than I should have. And they penalized me $3,000. And they're taking it out of my check, which is fine. I don't care. But I want to know, is there interest on that or not?
Rich, thanks for calling. First of all, to that basic question, Carrie, is there, does he have to pay interest on that? I don't know if you have that info off the top of your head.
You know, I don't have that info, but the interesting thing is, yeah, that does happen. That earnings test is really, really crazy on many ways, but you don't lose that money. I mean, they're going to build that benefit that they've taken away from you right now. Once you reach age 70, there's no longer the earnings test, so they don't care how much you make after that. But up until age 70, they're gonna do that, but they will build the benefit that they withhold from you now, that you know that 3,000 or what have you that you mentioned. You will get that back once you reach your full retirement age, is my understanding. It could be, it might be age 70. I need to double check that. I apologize, but you don't lose it, is the point.
Okay, so good news, Rich, for the long run. Thanks for calling in. Are there things we should think about, Carrie, if we're planning, we're in Rich's situation, taking Social Security in our 60s, still working though? I mean, how do we have to be careful about not making, I guess, too much money?
Yeah, you don't. I mean, you do and you don't. If you're making enough money that if they reduce your benefit, which they're just withholding it, you're going to get it back eventually. If you're making income, it shouldn't be a hardship for you, because you are making that income. So you're not relying on that benefit check to meet your monthly nut, right? That's the idea. I mean, they really want, the point is to try to discourage people from taking Social Security benefit when they, you know, are still working. And so they want to keep you on the job. That's the bottom line there. And so I think that the important thing to remember is that, yes, look it up. I mean, the IRS has a really good guide to all of this, IRS.gov. They can give you the particular numbers and so forth. But again, there is that earnings limit that you should be conscious of.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Jeff is with us in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I'd like to get your response to my three-prong approach to saving the Social Security Administration system. Number one, no more taxing benefits because you're going to be paying into the system for your whole life. Number two, you pay into the system and your employer matches 10% of your income. So in other words, if you earn $20,000 a year, you're going to pay $2,000 into the system. Your employer is going to match that another $2,000. Then once you start collecting benefits, again, like I said, no more taxing, but also throughout your lifetime, the government should be allowed to take a certain percentage of that money that's sitting there and invest it in the stock market, or like what Obama did when he invested in the auto industry. And then, you know, the government would buy stocks and then purchase and then sell the stocks later and possibly make a profit on them. I think that system would keep our economy going and it would keep people, with money in their pocket.
Jeff, thanks for the call. A lot of ideas out there, Carrie, about how to extend the current life of Social Security. Any thoughts on Jeff's three-part platform there?
Well, I love Jeff's creative thinking. This is what we need. We need this sort of thinking going on here in Washington, because we need to make some tweaks. And I think those are marvelous ideas. Particularly, I love the idea of the matching employer amount to pay into it. So that's all. The stock market is interesting. It's a little scary if we have dips like we just had this year. But overall, the market over a 20-year period does seem to outperform almost any other kind of investment.
Thanks for that call, Jeff, at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Social Security and retirement. Our guest is Carrie Hannon, retirement expert, author of a bunch of books on related topics. Back to your calls now with Greg in Green Bay. Greg, hi.
Hi there. My question lies within collecting Social Security at 62 or waiting till 67, which would be my max age for it. And when I do the math, if I start collecting it at 62 and versus wait until I'm 67, if you do the math, that extra money that I'll gain at age 67, it would take me till 79 years old to catch up. And then from that point, I would be better off. And that's neglecting any investment interest I would make in those years.
Greg, thanks for the call. Yeah, one tricky thing, of course, about retirement is, Carrie, we don't know how long we're going to live. How do we factor that sort of uncertainty into things?
Yeah, we don't have that crystal ball. So it's really an individual by individual choice. And, you can get a sense of how healthy you are, but we all know anything can happen. I want to make a quick correction. I think I don't know if I said it correctly. That earnings test that we were talking about with the last caller, that goes away at your full retirement age, not at age 70, but at your full retirement age.
All right. And that age, that means what? We've decided to take full Social Security at that point?
Yeah, if you've dipped in, if you're taking your Social Security and you've reached your full retirement age, 66, 67, then you can earn as much money as you want. There's no earnings test then.
Greg, thanks for the call. Time for one more caller. Tom is with us in Wauwatosa. Tom, hi.
Hello. I am currently 63 years old, and I went on disability 10 years ago. Currently, I get Social Security disability every month, as well as from the teacher's retirement system and from sick pay. But so I don't know when or if that's going to change my Social Security status when I reach 65 or 67, whatever it is, since I'm currently getting the Social Security disability benefits.
Tom, thanks for that call. Carrie, Tom brings up another huge part of Social Security, which is Social Security disability. Do you know if he switches over automatically at some point or has to do something?
I must say, I don't know the nuances of that particular thing. I do know that the Social Security disability program is actually in very good shape health-wise, that it is not one that they're worried about being depleted. in any way going forward. But I think he has a really great question there. And I'm sorry I can't give you the specific answer on that.
Tom, thanks for that call. Carrie, I want to get into wider issues around retirement. Social Security is one part of retirement planning. I think for most people, it alone probably isn't going to be enough, right?
No, and it was never really intended to be, Rob. I think it is an important piece. And for many people, it is, in fact, the lion's share of it. But we often think about, that the different stools, the different things that go into this. If you have a little, if you think of it in compartments, you've got your Social Security, you've got your retirement plan, hopefully through your workplace, if you've had either a 401k or if you're lucky enough to have a pension, which has been steadily going away. But that, and then your savings that you've put together on your own are those three things. And I like to put the fourth one being working during your retirement in some way as a safety net, even if it's seasonal, part-time, some kind of, as long as you're able to and you're still curious and you still have relevant skills, if you can keep earning a little bit just on the side, whatever that might be, that kind of gives you that, maybe it's that mad money, but it's the money that keeps you from having to dip into retirement accounts any more than you need to and let that money continue to grow. So it is challenging. And what's interesting, Rob, too, you were talking about coming out of the pandemic. This one of the big trends this year in 2022 is the people who retired during the pandemic unretired this year. Mm-hmm. So there was a real movement of people. And so I think this question that you're talking about today with your listeners about Social Security does come into play for a lot of people who did take early retirement, perhaps during the pandemic, or retired simply because they chose to, but may have started Social Security. And then when they got the jitters this year, decided to get back into the workplace. And then what do you do with your, if you've already started Social Security? So there are some moves that people can do there if they talk to the Social Security Administration or financial planner.
Carrie, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
Carrie Hannon is a personal finance and retirement expert, senior columnist for Yahoo Finance. Her books include In Control at 50 Plus, How to Succeed in the New World of Work. She joined us for a look at Social Security. Art and music education has been part of schools for decades, and there's been new movement toward STEAM education, adding art into science, technology, engineering, and math. There's a good chance you took art classes throughout elementary and middle school, maybe beyond. But our next guest says we can take things further and breathe new life into schools if we use the arts to rethink and ultimately save our education system. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you value having art and music classes in schools? What did it do for you, you think, as a person? And did your non-art classes encourage creativity in some way? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Erica Halverson is a professor of curriculum and instruction at UW-Madison's School of Education and the mayor of Whoopin' Soccer, a youth arts program based in Madison. Erica is the author of How the Arts Can Save Education, Transforming Teaching, Learning, and Instruction. She recently started a podcast. It's called Arts Educators Save the World. Erica, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Let's start with an important distinction here. I think when I think of art classes, I think elementary school, we took a break, walked over to art class, did art. Or high school, I took as many band classes as I could. You're talking about something different, though, kind of having an artistic mindset, I think, behind education. Can you talk about that?
Sure. First of all, I want to say that I also think about the concept of the arts more inclusively, to consider any kinds of disciplines where people produce things. So the performing arts, the visual arts, the media arts, all are encompassed under this umbrella of arts and arts education and art making. And then also to talk a little to your point about art making, not just as a distinct and separate task from the quote unquote real work of school, but of artistic ways of knowing and doing and being, as central to what it means to teach and to learn and to become human across all the spaces where we think about education and schooling.
Can you paint us a picture of what that might look like in the classroom?
Sure. So one of the core things that we learn when we make art is how to create representations. That is, how to take an idea, a concept, a story, and retranslate it using the medium of a particular art form. So a painting is a representation. A theatrical performance is a representation. A TikTok video is a representation. The same core mechanism that we value in art making is exactly what we hope our learners across all of our disciplines can learn to do in school. So a math equation is also a representation. It uses the tools of mathematics to communicate a complicated idea that is difficult to share using other mechanisms of communication. So my vision for reinvigorating life and creativity into schools is to recognize how the arts give young people access to the kinds of practices that we really care about that they do in all of their schooling lives across the full school day. So it might look like a project that stretches across the visual arts classroom and the mathematics classroom. It might look like using some of the tools of teaching in improvisation and applying those to the science classroom. It might be something as simple as giving kids the opportunity to take risks in their classroom space that they might not otherwise take without working together around an artistic process in order to get free them up to do the disciplinary academic work in the other parts of their school day.
You just mentioned risk-taking, and I wanted to talk about that a little, because, you know, at various points in my schooling and professional life, the main thing I wanted to do was not be wrong.
Yeah.
And that isn't always the most conducive to learning stuff. Can you talk about the value of risk-taking and the opportunity to be wrong?
Absolutely. I mean, I think one of the biggest challenges we face in the current failure-focused environment of schooling is how do we communicate both to kids, but also to educators, that failure is a part of learning and not a lack of learning? How do we encourage learning environments, that is classrooms, after school spaces, sports teams, interactions between tutors and students? How do we encourage them to think about trying new things, trying ways of knowing, putting out there ideas that you may or may not believe to be ultimately the best answer as part of what it means to do learning? And learning to take risks is the most effective mechanism for that. And for better or worse, as you probably know, and as all listeners know, you can't simply say to people, okay, now it's time to take risks, and magically people open up toward risk-taking. You have to, what we call in education speak, scaffold their capacity for risk-taking. And I love the scaffolding metaphor because it invokes images of a building held up at first by an external set of tools that then slowly are taken away as the infrastructure for the building is built and can then stand on its own. And so in my book, and in my work with arts educators, I talk a lot about what are the kinds of scaffolds that arts practices allow us to build so that we can eventually take them away and embed risk-taking into the everyday practices of teaching and learning.
Talking to Erica Halverson from the UW-Madison School of Education. New podcast called Arts Educators Save the World. You could join in at 800-642-1234 as we talk about arts and creativity, how to get them into the classroom, not just the art classroom or music classroom, but all day long. If you're a teacher, what do you think of the ideas you're hearing? Are you able to do this? Have you found ways to do this in your own classes? As a student, past or present, were there teachers, were there classes that really stimulated your creativity And did it help you learn more? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Erica, this new podcast, Art Educators Save the World, just out last week. Want to listen to a bit of it? Lin-Manuel Miranda on here and Robert Lopez and their teacher, Barbara Ames, in a conversation. Here's Lin-Manuel Miranda talking about a life-changing teacher.
It was life-changing for me. I think the direct education we got from Barbara wanting us to like go headlong into running our own show and the empowerment that comes with student-run theater, because I saw from seventh grade onward what could be done. And then I directed West Side Story my senior year for musical rep. And I grabbed the stuff from the movie I wanted to. I did the Boy Girl America. I swapped Krupke and Cool. I went to the Barbara Ames School of Make the Best Show Possible for Your Students.
Also, I believe your teacher, Barbara Ames, was the let's put on a show model of teaching. Can you talk a little bit about what you got out of that conversation?
Oh, so many things. I mean, not to sell my own radio, but I would encourage everyone to subscribe and listen to these amazing conversations. The idea behind the podcast in general is successful artists talking with their mentors about the impact that arts education has had on their lives. And we started with Lin-Manuel Miranda and Bobby Lopez because they had the same transformational elementary school music teacher as did I. And we, all of us, attribute the kinds of experiences that Barbara Ames gave us directly to the kinds of human beings we became. And part of that was Barbara's commitment to engaging all of us in the process of making theater and making music. Part of it was the ways in which she encouraged us to take risks in our own artistic lives as pretty young children. You know, she was our teacher when we were in kindergarten through sixth grade. And you hear it a little bit from Lynn, and the same is true for myself. And, you know, if listeners don't know Robert Lopez's name just from hearing it, he is the co-writer of Frozen, the movie soundtrack and musical, along with several other Broadway musicals. So these are incredibly accomplished composers, songwriters, some of the greatest of the 21st century. And Barbara is the one who gave us access to our creative selves as young children and encouraged us to carry that forward through creative projects in our schooling lives beyond our time with her, as Lynn said, into high school, both of them obviously into college. And for myself, as an artist turned academic, thinking about the relationship between the stories that she helped me figure out how to tell and improving other people's lives through education, it is an unmatched set of experiences that we got through our education with Barbara.
We're talking to Erica Halverson, professor at UW-Madison School of Education, author of the book, How the Arts Can Save Education. Her new podcast, we were just talking about it, is called Arts Educators Save the World. She joined us to talk about her research on the value of art in schools and not just in separate art classes. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Did you find in your schooling, say, a teacher, a class, a style of teaching that helped boost your creativity? And did that help you grasp difficult topics along the way? If you're a teacher yourself, do you find ways to encourage creativity in your students? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to Erica Halverson, UW-Madison education professor, author of the book, How the Arts Can Save Education, with us today to talk about a research on the importance of using art in the classroom, not just in the art classroom. You can join in at 800-642-1234 to share your experiences, maybe your questions for our guest about how to put some of these ideas into practice. Again, 800-642-1234. Let's bring in a caller now. Michael is with us in Spring Green. Michael, hi.
Hi. I was just mentioning the fact that I'm a professor emeritus, taught at the University of Wisconsin-Madison for many decades in the art department. And I had students, young adults from all kinds of different fields that were in my classes, different majors, everything from computer science to medicine. And I always expected that out of the group, maybe one would become an artist. But what I think the arts really contributes to a bigger picture is the idea that the critique and criticism is a very valuable skill. And it encourages critical thinking, which can apply to just about any profession. And I think art people that have art backgrounds, see things differently than just any other person does. And it's because of that ability to see things in different ways that they can apply those skills to just about any profession.
Michael, thanks for the call. Erica, what do you think?
Yeah, that Michael was not a plant, although I think very well could have been. Critique practice is a great technique for engaging teachers who maybe aren't arts teachers in some of the ways of knowing and doing that we really value in the arts. In my own classes at the university, I teach folks who are planning to become teachers. And I also teach folks who are artists who want to become teaching artists, that is, teach in their lives, but maybe not become certified classroom teachers. And one of my favorite days is a day I call getting beyond good job, which is where we learn how to talk to one another about the work that we make to develop some of those critique skills that Michael was talking about. So learning to notice, that is, engaging with a piece of artwork, whether that's a piece of visual art or performance art, and learning to notice things in the work is an excellent mechanism for developing a teaching and learning technique that can be utilized across different disciplines, because it allows us to engage with one another's work without evaluation, first of all, and by giving the kind of productive feedback that allows people to improve on their representations, on the ways in which they're communicating ideas to each other.
Michael, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. And Erica, for somebody wanting to put that idea into practice, I think we hear words like critique and criticism and think, here's how the thing you did was bad. And that's clearly not what you're talking about. For somebody, maybe a teacher out there listening who wants to do this in the classroom tomorrow, what could that look like?
Yes. So there, I mentioned learning to notice. I have a very simple set of questions that I use to teach about critique that I've adapted from Harvard Project Zero, which is a very well-known kind of arts education research house around the country. And they have a lot of free resources on their website. But my kind of simplified version of critique is having people present work to one another and asking everyone to respond to the questions, what do you notice? What does this remind you of? And what do you still want to know? And the reason I like those questions is that they surface the parts of someone's work that stand out to others without any evaluative language associated with it, right? So for example, someone might notice the vibrant colors in a painting. That doesn't mean you like the vibrant colors, you don't like the vibrant colors, but you notice those colors. And that is an opportunity for feedback and conversation, where the artist can say, yeah, I was really thinking the vibrant colors could do A, B, or C. Or, you know, I hadn't really intended for vibrant colors. I see that everyone is noticing that. Here are the kinds of changes I'm going to make to this work in order to make the colors less vibrant so that that is not the first thing that people notice when they examine my work.
Talking to Erica Halverson, professor at UW-Madison School of Education. Erica has a new podcast called Arts Educators Save the World, talking about creativity in our schools. Erica, something that always strikes me, you know, when I think back to my math education, a lot of it was a chore, drudgery in a lot of ways. And then when I interview mathematicians, they're talking about how much creativity goes into problem solving and how much they play with numbers. I mean, they're doing hard stuff too. How do we get that spirit from the pros and bring it into the stuff that to K through 12 kids are getting?
Oh, that is such a great question. You know, I have also heard that from mathematicians. And you hear all the time about the connections between making math and making music, making math and making art. There's some really exciting research around how very old arts practices like weaving are highly mathematized. And there's incredible research going on that starts with the mathematized arts practices and uses those practices as a mechanism to move toward some of the more standard representational tools that we use in math classes. So I would say step one begins with identifying the arts practices that are themselves mathematical. And rather than requiring we start with the standardized math practices and require students pass through those before, quote unquote, getting to the good stuff, what if we started with the good stuff and used those opportunities as a way in to the standardized mathematics practices?
We just have a couple minutes left, and I don't want to get out of this without talking about whooping soccer.
Sure.
I was going to try to describe it to people, and I don't think I have the right words. What is whooping soccer? What do you do?
Yep. So Whoopin' Soccer is a community arts outreach program that's based here in Madison, Wisconsin. We are an artist-in-residence program, so we bring professional teaching artists into third and fourth grade classrooms, and we work with an entire grade of students on creative expression through writing and improvisation and performance. We each week brings a different theme for creative expression, from writing and telling stories from pictures to telling true stories, to learning a little about playwriting and the tools of playwriting as a form of expression, to writing arguments that allow young people to make change in their world. We give them opportunities to write together, to write alone, to dictate, to perform each other's stories. And then at the conclusion of the residency, our group of teaching artists, many of whom are also professional performers in the Madison community, create an entirely original vaudeville-style sketch comedy show of the kids' work. And we bring the kids to the Madison Youth Arts Center, and they all have an opportunity to see their work performed on a professional stage by professional artists as a mechanism of validating their ideas as not only creative, but valuable for the community at large.
And in just our last few moments, Erica, it's a new school year. Leave us with a bit of encouragement.
It's a new school year. I think all of us are entering it with a bit of trepidation. I like to lead with joy. I like to lead with the idea that coming together in community to make new ideas is an act of joy. And arts practices are the best way I know to infuse joy into our learning systems. So I would say, let's start the year with joy by valuing the artistic ways of knowing and doing that kids naturally bring to learning. And let's lift those mechanisms of expression up as valid, as valued, and as a way to bring all kids productively into our learning environments.
Erica, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Erica Halverson, professor at the UW-Madison School of Education and mayor of Whoopin' Soccer, a youth arts program we were just talking about based in Madison. Erica is the author of the book, How the Arts Can Save Education, Transforming Teaching, Learning, and Instruction. She just launched a podcast. It's called Arts Educators Save the World. And you could still share your stories of creativity in teaching and learning, maybe an art class or a creative teacher who inspired you at some point along the way. You can let us know about it over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can also email ideas@WPR.org.